Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How close did America come to a second civil war? In February of 1868, Congress impeached President Andrew Johnson for violating the Tenure of Office Act, a measure enacted by overridden veto specifically to keep the firebrand successor to Abraham Lincoln from replacing War Secretary Edwin M. Stanton. But what made that act so unconscionable to Johnson's opponents, and did his ultimate acquittal demonstrate the procedure's value or its futility? David O. Stewart is an attorney and a history writer. He writes about this critical moment in America's past in his new book, Impeached, The Trial of President Andrew Johnson and the Fight for Lincoln's Legacy. David, welcome back to Think.
Thanks for having me.
This was not simply a country that was divided north from south at the time of the impeachment. The Republican Party was comfortably in control of Congress, but was highly competitive, made up of these factions. Can you talk about the difference in outlook between radical Republicans and those who were considered moderate or conservative?
Yes, it all grew out of the slavery fight. You had abolitionists who were really fervent before and during the Civil War. They tended to become the radical Republicans afterwards, although it's not a uniform rule, but that's the tendency. And the definition radical Republican, which is a term that strikes the modern era somewhat oddly, really described people who wanted to do a great deal to assist the freed slaves and who were not particularly interested in allowing the former rebels, the former Confederates, to have power after the war, and went to some considerable lengths to keep them out of power.
So let's step back a moment and talk about how Andrew Johnson made his way into office. He was initially tapped by Abraham Lincoln, not, of course, as vice president, but as military governor of Tennessee. What sort of track record did he have in that position?
It was, on balance, a good one. The job was very difficult. The Union forces didn't really control Tennessee. The North and South fought through Tennessee until the end of 1864. So it was a hazardous duty. He was always a brave man. He had lots of personal courage, and he stood quite firm for the Union and tried very diligently to create a stable situation in Tennessee, which was pretty much impossible at the time, given the military situation.
What sort of relationship did Johnson have with Lincoln?
Not much of a relationship at all. They had served in Congress at the same time in the 1840s, and there's no evidence they took any particular notice of each other. And Johnson was a Democrat at the time, Lincoln was a Whig. And Johnson and Lincoln had corresponded formally because of their duties during the Civil War, but there's absolutely no evidence of any kind of personal relationship or really much experience with each other.
So why did Hannibal Hamlin not follow Lincoln into a second term as vice president?
Straight politics. Lincoln was very concerned about being reelected with good cause. The war was not uniformly popular by any means.
And at that moment, not going well when Lincoln was about to be reelected.
They had had some hard times since Gettysburg and Vicksburg, and he was doing what we would call today a move to the middle. He renamed the Republican Party the Union Party. He wanted to have the Republican Party was identified somewhat as a northern anti-slavery party, and he wanted to have a broader appeal, and so he wanted someone from the border states or from the South who was a Democrat. Not just a moderate Republican, but a Democrat. And there really were only a couple, and Andrew Johnson fit that bill perfectly. And that's why he was selected. It was just to try to appeal to more voters.
So Johnson started out a pretty well-respected choice to serve as vice president, but he started things off on a really bizarre note, just taking the oath of office as vice president.
It's a truly appalling moment for him and for the country. Nobody can explain it terribly well, but he really got falling down drunk the day of his inauguration and gave a totally incoherent and embarrassing address to the Senate and all the gathered dignitaries. He actually left Washington for several weeks after that, just to stay out of the public eye. And it was such a terrible way to enter the public consciousness and be a leader on the national stage for the first time. And thereafter, as president, anytime something controversial happened, it was often just shrugged off as, oh, well, Andy's drinking again. And that was a pretty tough thing for him to overcome.
Was he, do you think, by contemporary evaluations, an alcoholic?
Well, it's a great question. Contemporary standards were different. We were a hard-drinking people. And that's the only occasion on which there's a record that he was drunk at a public event. And we don't know if it was nerves or if he was ill or what. There's every evidence that he was a stout drinker and liked it. Ulysses Grant had a lifelong problem with alcohol, a contemporary. It was better than the water in many places, so people drank a lot of whiskey. And, the standards weren't that compelling, but if you show up at your inauguration drunk, then negative inferences are drawn.
Yeah. Well, at that first inaugural speech for the vice presidency, he sort of denounced Lincoln in a number of ways. What kind of commitment did he profess to Lincoln's agenda in the days immediately following the assassination?
Well, that was another thing that happened, was he seemed sort of off his stride, frankly, and you can understand it. I mean, the assassination was a huge thing. The war was ending. We were going to have to try to get these warring sections of the country back together, but he made some very controversial public statements about the need to punish the traitors, meaning the Confederate leaders. One Northerner said, well, we should hang a baker's dozen of them, and Johnson said that's not enough. He sounded quite vengeful after Lincoln. And within a few more weeks, he completely flipped and changed his position and took a very conciliatory position towards the Southerners. The real effect of that politically was to, again, undercut his credibility. It made people just wonder who he was and, was he reliable? It was damaging.
And we should stop here and say that he was not a guy known for liking to sort of delegate responsibility.
No, he's a hardworking guy. He had, he came from nothing. He was a very poor boy. And he did all the work himself. He worked from dawn until 10 or 11 at night every day. You could not fault him on his work ethic.
Now, we know that Lincoln had espoused an essentially merciful policy toward the South at the end of the war, but as you demonstrate in the book, he was a vastly more skillful politician than Johnson and would have known better than to sort of alienate Congress by suddenly going soft on the South. Do you expect he might have, in fact, changed his direction a bit had he lived to complete that second term?
I think he would have had to. And, we're in the land of speculation, which is fun, but, it's speculation. But what Johnson found, and Lincoln would have also, is if you wanted to return power to the southern states, they were going to pick the former Confederates to lead them. And that was not politically acceptable for the rest of the country. 600,000 men had died in that war. And you could not return the leaders of the rebellion to power. It just was not going to work politically. And I think Lincoln would have seen the Southerners do that and just would have said, gentlemen, we can't have this. We'll do something else. And Johnson, however, took a complete hands-off approach. He just had this almost metaphysical belief in states' rights, and anything the states did was okay with him. And so he accepted it, which really soured his relationship with the rest of the country.
And he seems not at all to have been interested in restoring or guaranteeing rights for African Americans beyond just freedom from slavery.
That's right. He was a slaveholder himself. He never spoke of slavery in moral terms, and he accepted the 13th Amendment and the end of slavery, but it never was an agenda item for him. And once the slaves were free, he was completely finished trying to help them, and that was a huge bone of contention between him and Congress. The violence against the freed slaves in the South was horrifying. The new laws that were adopted by the Southern states to limit the freed slaves were pretty appalling. They really, in some ways, restored slavery. So his unwillingness to intervene in that, again, completely soured his relationship with the rest of the country.
So how do you reconcile that with the writing that much later Woodrow Wilson would do about Reconstruction and talk about how Johnson came in and essentially overthrew the entire civilization of the American South?
Well, there's a saying that the North won the war and the South won the peace, and it is along the lines of our sort of cultural norms after the war, and you know, some of this is frankly racism, was that it was important for the white Southerners to continue to have control. Johnson himself said that the worst evil the country had ever faced was the possibility that the freed slaves would vote. That he said that would be worse than the Civil War itself. And that sense that it was so important to restore sort of white control dominated our history in our history writing. When you look at a movie like Birth of a Nation, the D.W. Griffith classic silent movie from 1915, he glorifies the Ku Klux Klan for protecting white Southerners from the horrors of black control. It was a deep-seated racism that permeated the country for at least 80 years after the war.
On the other hand, for some Northerners who did push for African Americans to get the right to vote from the beginning, was there also a sense politically that these people would vote with them as opposed to with any politicians from the South, and therefore that would sort of, in addition to providing voting rights for these individuals, it would really sort of bode well for the interests of the North?
Of course, and that was, you know, the Republicans would say, well, we just want these people to have the rights that everybody else does. But they knew that the freed slaves were not dumb. They knew that the Republicans and Lincoln had brought their freedom. The war had brought their freedom. They were going to vote Republican. Every chance they got, they voted Republican. And so the Democrats were opposed to this, and the Republicans were in favor of it because they wanted more political power. So although it was an issue of rights, it quickly became translated into an issue of political power.
How did political patronage work under Andrew Johnson?
Well, until our Civil Service Act in the 1880s, every federal job was a patronage job, was just appointed at the pleasure of the president, which was true in Johnson's time. There were 41,000 federal jobs that he could fill with anybody he wanted. He was in an awkward position. He had been elected on the Republican ticket, but he was a Democrat. And so he started out leaving a lot of Republicans in power, in position, because they were the people he came with. But as time went on, they became very hostile to him, so he started replacing them with Democrats. And this, of course, created great anger among Republicans who said, wait a second, we won the election in 1864. We're entitled to these, the victor belongs the spoils assumption. So it was a very bitter thing, frankly, over who was entitled to these jobs. And, you know, that's something our American politicians in the 1860s fought hard over. And it was another reason the Republicans were angry with him.
History writer David O. Stewart is my guest. His new book is called Impeached, The Trial of President Andrew Johnson and the Fight for Lincoln's Legacy. You can join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible in part by SMU summer camp programs, helping kids create, design, and think in fun new ways in Plano and on the Dallas main campus. Details online at smu.edu/camp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris. Chris Boyd. David O. Stewart is my guest this hour. His new book is called Impeached, The Trial of President Andrew Johnson and the Fight for Lincoln's Legacy. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. So we've talked already about the fact that Johnson opposed the idea that African Americans would get the right to vote. On the other hand, Secretary of War Edwin N. Stanton, who had been there under Lincoln, very much supported this idea. And Republicans in Congress were well aware that Johnson planned to replace Stanton, and they did something to make that impossible, or they thought make it impossible.
Well, they made it awfully hard. They enacted this statute, the Tenure of Office Act, which limited his ability to get rid of executive officials. And it's a wonderful example of how our Constitution, which has, of course, been a wonderful document all these years, is not perfect. It describes how you appoint these officials. They're appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate, but it doesn't describe how you get rid of them. And as a result, Congress adopted the view that it had the power to approve the termination of any of these officials. And so after the statute was enacted, Johnson finally decided to try to get rid of Stanton, who was actively undermining his presidency. Stanton was an opponent within the president's inner circle. And the Senate refused to go along. As a result, Johnson was stuck with this guy, and he decided to get rid of him anyway. So he appointed a man interim Secretary of War, a not very distinguished soldier named Lorenzo Thomas, and sent him over to take control of the War Department. Stanton refused to leave and sent him away. So for 3 months, we had two Secretaries of War. Stanton barricaded himself in the War Department. He cooked his meals in the fireplace and refused to leave. And Thomas was going to cabinet meetings but had no access to the War Department itself. It was a preposterous situation. And it was the immediate trigger to the impeachment vote in the House of Representatives.
And we should say that Johnson had already vetoed the Tenure of Office Act, and then Congress overrode him in swift measure.
The Republicans had a three-quarters majority in Congress, and most major legislation in this era, much of it dealing with the South and Reconstruction, was passed over Johnson's vetoes.
Mm-hmm. So what role did Ulysses S. Grant have in pushing for Johnson's impeachment?
Well, he played an essential role in a couple of ways. One was he was general-in-chief of the armies at the time, and so we had an occupying army in the South, and he was in charge of it. And when Johnson would try to rein in the army, because he didn't want to have the army there, he wanted the white Southerners to be in control. And Grant thought that was wrong, that Congress had said that the army should be in control and should protect the freed slaves. Grant would, with Secretary of War Stanton's connivance, tell his commanders in the South to ignore the president's orders. It's quite a remarkable episode in insubordination, frankly. And that fed the flames. And then finally, when Johnson was trying to get rid of Stanton, he thought Grant would work with him. Grant didn't like Stanton either. Nobody liked Stanton. He was a very arrogant, difficult man. But at the last minute, Grant refused to support him, refused to support the president. And he got in a public argument with Johnson over what he had agreed to do. They called each other's liars in the public press, which was an amazing spectacle. And it really set the groundwork for the impeachment, because Johnson did not have the stature at that time to go toe-to-toe in public with Grant. Grant was the hero of the war, and Stanton was the guy who showed up drunk at his own inauguration.
I was surprised to read that Grant later admitted that he regretted some of his actions against Johnson during the impeachment.
Yes, a few of the Republicans did. Grant was, frankly, not all that... he wasn't a terrifically aggressive public official generally. And I think he had the sense that, Johnson only had 10 months left in his term. I got sucked into this really nasty name-calling with the president. I've been president now. I know how hard the job is. And maybe I shouldn't have done that. And there was some remorse over that among a few Republicans. I actually think they shouldn't have felt remorse, that the impeachment effort was, frankly, a healthy reaction against a president who was causing the government, the country great pain.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. David O. Stewart is my guest. Let's go to Andy in Dallas. Hi, Andy.
Hi. Two quick questions. One, is it true, and maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves, but that in the actual deliberations of the senators voting on conviction, that those records have never actually been released? And second, is it also true that the seven or so Republicans like Edmund Ross and others who voted to acquit Johnson were somehow paid off with patronage positions?
Oh, Andy, you asked the best questions. The records are generally available. And, you know, there were plenty of backroom negotiations. We don't know exactly what was said. And it became a totally political event. So there's lots we don't know about, but what happened in public was made available to the public. There were speeches given by the Senate in executive session, which were not transcribed, but all the senators left the Senate immediately and described what everybody said. So we really do sort of know what happened. So that's not a problem with secrecy there. The secrecy is in the offstage bargaining that happened. And there's a lot of evidence. And I really was surprised and tried to develop it at some length. There's a lot of evidence of corruption in the final vote. As you mentioned, Johnson needed seven Republican votes to cross the aisle. He had 12 solid votes. He needed 19 to avoid conviction. So he had to get seven Republicans to vote for him who would not have ordinarily voted for him. And there's a lot of evidence that some were just flat-out bribed. Others were persuaded to change their vote for patronage reasons, as you suggest. Edmund Ross, whom you mentioned, of Kansas, is the most obviously likely candidate. I think I'm quite convinced that his vote was for sale and he sold it.
And the other half of that myth, though, about the seven Republican dissenters was that they sort of died broken men, at least politically. They sacrificed their own careers.
Yes, and I certainly had that. So many of people in my generation, I'm 58, our view of this episode was molded by John Kennedy's Profiles in Courage. He has a chapter about Edmund Ross and calls him his vote for Johnson perhaps the most heroic act in American history. And so it was stunning to me to discover so much corruption, and that I ended up concluding that Ross had sold his vote. And it was a real revelation, and it shows, frankly, some of the misunderstandings of history that we develop.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is David O. Stewart, whose new book is called Impeached, The Trial of President Andrew Johnson and the Fight for Lincoln's Legacy. Let's go next to Jonathan in Dallas. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Yes, David, I have a question. As a slave owner, did Andrew Johnson have any descendants from the slaves that he owned? And if so, did it shape his views on slavery after slavery was abolished?
He was a slave owner. He did support the 13th Amendment, which freed the slaves. Ultimately, he did support it. I do not know if we have a Thomas Jefferson, Sally Hemings-type situation with Andrew Johnson. When I took the tour of his house, they pointed out, the National Park Service guide pointed out photos of the children of the cook and, you know, suggested that they had not had a slave parent, but a slave father, but there had been a white person, white man as the father. Didn't have to be Johnson if there was one. So there are questions about this, and frankly, the institution of slavery did nothing but foster such questions because it was quite routine. He didn't own a great many slaves. He never had a plantation. They were just household help in his house. But his attitudes towards blacks was very much of the conventional Southern white, that they, were simply helpless, lower form of life, that they really were not even human.
There's another interesting element to the acquittal of Andrew Johnson, which is the fact that he did not have, throughout his entire time as president, he did not have a vice president. Can you talk about that?
Well, we didn't have the 25th Amendment at the time, so there was no way to replace him as vice president, and the when he became president, and the man who would have succeeded him as president was a senator from Ohio named Benjamin Wade, a very obscure figure at this point in our history. Ben Wade was an admirable guy in a lot of ways. He was a tough guy. He believed in women's rights, which was pretty unusual for those days. But he scared a lot of Republicans. And because he was a very aggressive radical Republican, he was very much in favor of protecting the freed slaves. They feared him on economic issues as well. He was sort of a populist. And one newspaper wrote after the acquittal that Andrew Johnson is president because Ben Wade would have been his successor. That was a reason people didn't vote to convict Johnson, and there's some truth to it. He did scare some of the senators.
Well, and when you talk about him scaring people, he literally came to office sort of ready to brawl. He put pistols on his desk.
Well, this was that event was in the 1850s when you have to understand the context. Senator Charles Sumner of Massachusetts had just been beaten into a coma by a congressman from South Carolina, who caned him for about 5 minutes with nobody intervening to protect Sumner. Sumner got trapped under his desk and, you know, was an invalid for 2 years after that because, from the beating. After that, Wade came in, put his pistols on the desk, and said, if you guys want to fight, I'll take you on. And there were a lot of people who thought Ben Wade had some admirable gumption.
Was Wade actively campaigning to get Johnson convicted?
There's not much evidence of it. It would have been unseemly at the time. We still had this attitude that, you know, high office should come to people who deserve it and not people who seek it. And it was always sort of a myth even then. But he does not seem to have been among the leaders in the scheming and the politicking that was going on, although he did pick a cabinet. We know that, that the day before the vote was going to happen, he had a list of new cabinet members he was going to appoint if he became president, and he actually went to see Ulysses Grant to clear them with Grant because Grant was assumed that he would be elected president in the fall, and he didn't want to do anything that would make Grant unhappy.
So how did the trial play out in Washington, and what sort of attention did it get from newspapers across the country?
Well, the opening of the conflict, when Stanton was first barricaded in the War Office and the House of Representatives was debating impeachment. You know, the House votes to impeach and then the Senate tries the case. It was a totally riveting event. There were fears of coup, of revolution, of armed troops in the streets. You know, we had 1 million veterans around the country who had just laid down their arms 3 years before. And newspapers had stories that 20,000 men are coming from Kentucky and, you know, 10,000 from Ohio, and there was real terror. And as time went on, and this is one of the positives of a very difficult and not very attractive situation in a lot of ways, the impeachment process sort of let temperatures subside and let people cool off a bit. And within a few weeks, people realized that there wasn't going to be revolution, and there wasn't going to be a second civil war, and we were going to have this trial. And the trial was the morality play for the whole nation. So that became, again, riveting, and people followed it incredibly closely. The transcripts were carried in newspapers all across the country. But the sort of rage and terror level had been ratcheted down, which was I think, is testament to the impeachment as a good constitutional device.
Do you think that the American people really had a stomach for going into another war that could have been just as devastating, if not more so, than the one they had finished?
You know, who am I to say? Because I read newspapers and letters of the leaders, and there were 35 million people. I think most wars happen because we stumble into them. They very rarely happen because, you know, somebody wakes up in the morning and the whole nation decides we're going to war. And I think there was very much the potential to stumble into war at that time. There would have been, there were so many good reasons not to. The South really didn't have the ability to wage a war. And I think it would have only been conflict or riots or something like that. I don't think he would have had big armies in the field the way we had in the Civil War. But was there potential for real violence? Yes, I think there was.
So how effective was Johnson able to be as president after he was acquitted?
Ah, that's a fascinating point. He made some commitments to a Republican senator who crossed the aisle to vote for him, James Grimes of Iowa, that he would essentially behave himself, that's my language, not him, his, after he was acquitted. And he did stop making really outrageous speeches. He had had a tendency to make quite provocative speeches as president. But his actions continued to be just as provocative. He continued to veto any congressional legislation that was, you know, he viewed as limiting the states' rights of the South or as helping the freed slaves inappropriately. And he continued to appoint really dubious people, really paying off on some of the patronage promises he had made. So there was a change in his tone, but I think substantively, Andrew Johnson was still Andrew Johnson after the trial.
So he was chastened, but only on the surface.
Yes. And, you know, that wasn't all bad. It was good to have him not be as provocative and controversial. And he was a lame duck. He had hoped to be nominated by the Democrats for president in 1868 and actively angled for the nomination. He was second in the balloting for a while at the Democratic convention. But once that fell apart, he really was a lame duck. And, you know, everything became easier because the country knew we were going to be rid of him.
David O. Stewart is my guest. His new book is called Impeached, The Trial of President Andrew Johnson and the Fight for Lincoln's Legacy. You can join us right now by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible in part by SMU summer camp programs, helping kids create, design, and think in fun new ways in Plano and on the Dallas main campus. Details online at smu.edu/camp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Historian and attorney David O. Stewart is my guest. His new book is called Impeached, The Trial of President Andrew Johnson and the Fight for Lincoln's Legacy. If you'd like to join us, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. David, the exodus from office of Andrew Johnson is also very interesting. He is the last president to have boycotted his successor's inauguration.
Yeah, he really hated Ulysses Grant, and he actually assembled his cabinet. They thought they were picking him up, and they were going to go up to the Capitol to view the inauguration, and then Johnson never left. He finally went downstairs, got in his carriage, and rode off. So he really just would not give Grant the satisfaction. It was a pretty graceless exit.
And the strangest thing is that a couple of years later, he found himself back in the Senate, having been appointed to an unexpired term, and he was there representing Tennessee for a short time.
Yes, he very much wanted to stay in politics. He loved politics. It had been his life. He held every position you could be elected to in Tennessee virtually. And he ran for Congress and lost. He tried to get appointed to a Senate term and lost, and then he did win. Got appointed to a Senate term. And he wasn't that old a man. He was 67 when he went back to the Senate, where he had served before the Civil War. And he did only give one speech, which was a rousing denunciation of Ulysses Grant as president. And then Congress recessed, and he died probably of a stroke during the recess.
Did he remain pretty popular in Tennessee? You said he lost the congressional race.
He was controversial always, and he was, in some ways, a man without a party, and that was really his biggest problem. You know, people in Tennessee knew him well. They liked him over the years, but there were a lot of, frankly, former Confederates who thought he was a traitor to the Confederate cause by standing with the Union. There were some Republicans who thought he was a traitor to the Republican Party as president by backing essentially the Southern states and in opposing the Republicans in Congress. So he had a problem finding a home, and it really is a testament to his fortitude and his determination that he was able to get through that. And then it was really 7 years after he had been had left the White House, he was returned to the Senate.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Ron in Cedar Hill. Hello, Ron.
Hello. I have a two-part question that I'll just give both parts at the same time. Did Andrew Johnson implement as much as he could of Lincoln's Reconstruction plans? And second, if he did so, how might Lincoln have fared if he had not died and he tried to implement the very policies that got Andrew Johnson in trouble?
Well, those are wonderful questions and hard ones because we're playing the what-if game. I do think when he ultimately found his feet, when he was first president, he did try to pursue what Lincoln thought would be his policies. The result was that the white Southerners returned the former Confederates to power. You know, Georgia elected the former vice president of the Confederacy to the Senate. And the Northerners, you know, said they're sending men here to Washington who have the blood of our husbands and sons on their hands. They were enraged. And had Lincoln encountered that, I think he would have found some way to try to bring some people together. What Johnson did is he denounced Congress. Congress ended up excluding the Southern senators and representatives. He denounced Congress as illegitimate, said they had no right to do that, and that any legislation adopted by Congress had no power, no force. He made the fight worse. His bodyguard once described him as the best hater I ever met. He was an angry guy, and if he got angry, he had a terrible time climbing down. And I think that's the fundamental problem with his presidency. Lincoln would have run into exactly the same problem, and I think Lincoln would have tried. It would have been very hard, but he certainly would have tried a lot harder to find some common ground, to find a way to get people to work together instead of just digging in deeper and deeper.
Well, you know, your subtitle includes this phrase, the fight for Lincoln's legacy. Do you have the sense that Johnson felt any personal obligation to protect and preserve and put forth Lincoln's legacy as a good and important thing?
Yes, I do, and it's a good question. And but we have to see it as the legacy as he saw it. So, for Johnson, the legacy wasn't equality for black people. You know, Lincoln had his mystical belief was in the message of the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal. Johnson's mystical belief was in the power of the states, in states' rights, and that's sort of a theoretical difference, but when you get down to these tough political problems, you come out very differently. So Johnson says, well, the Southern states can do what they want to the freed slaves. And I don't think Lincoln would have said that. And I think he would have had a very different view. So when I say the fight for Lincoln's legacy, Lincoln had two great legacies. One was to preserve the Union, which Johnson fully subscribed to. But the other was this notion of equality and opportunity, which Johnson simply didn't care about for black people. And I think that was where he just, you know, didn't get it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Fort Worth and speak with Jim. Hey, Jim.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Chris.
Hi.
I have a question about Johnson. Before he was president, actually, but he was a Southern white male, and did he feel that with Lincoln's kind of policies towards the South when he was vice president that the Civil War was a necessary war? I know Lincoln did not think that the war was necessary and that he did not like going to war, but did he think that it was that there should have been a, that the South should have fought for independence the way they did?
He did not. And it's fascinating to read what he said. Even after the war, he lectured Southerners, and he said, you know, if you wanted to preserve slavery, the way to preserve slavery would have been to stay in the Union. Because if you'd stayed in the Union, nobody ever would have bothered slavery. And his view was the way you protect your rights is you continue to play the political game. And the real argument before the Civil War wasn't over slavery in the South, but whether slavery would be extended into the West. And that's what was the passionate argument. And Johnson really didn't see secession as in any way justified, and he did completely support the Union cause during the war.
Let's go next to Trudy in Fort Worth. Hi, Trudy.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead, please.
I have heard that Johnson ordered the military to kill every Indian until there was no other Indian alive, and that he said the only good Indian was a dead Indian. Does your guest know anything about this?
Trudy, I have not run across that. He had to spend a considerable amount of time on Indian issues. It was something, of course, we had neglected as a nation. He wasn't particularly enlightened on the subject. He wasn't pro-Indian that I've ever seen. But I've never seen any evidence of that sort of attitude. There were a lot of treaties at issue to try to, you know, frankly, take Indian lands to build railroads and to have settlers take them over, and he supported all of that effort.
Which was also sort of an extension of Lincoln's policies, was it not?
It was our national policy. Mm-hmm. We wanted the land. I mean, it's just that simple. And you know, Lincoln was part of that as well. But I did not ever come upon evidence of that sort of bloodthirstiness.
Let's go next to David in Plano. Hello, David.
Hi. Great show as always. I wanted to ask the author if he could talk a little bit about Andrew Johnson's religious background. I had heard from other folks before that he was actually a Unitarian, not in the sense that we know Unitarians today, but at the time. And I was curious to know what his religious beliefs were, if he was a practicing Unitarian, or did he actually profess to belong to a different kind of religion?
He did not belong to any congregation, and never did. He did attend services while president, and he knew his Bible. And as you know, he was a self-taught man, and in a little country town where he grew up, the Bible was one of the things you read. And so he was very familiar with that, and he looked in the Bible for lessons, and he knew his Bible stories, but he was not religious in a conventional sense. One of his secretaries, and secretary then was what that is what we would call sort of a close aide, a staff person, said that if he actually had a Bible, it was the Constitution. He wasn't really focused on the next life or on questions of religion. He was very much focused on government and politics, and was not. There is no evidence that he was a classical believer. I have not seen a reference to him as a Unitarian, but I understand you to mean that as simply, I take it, not sort of having a conventional view of Christ. And I saw no evidence that he did think of Christ as his Savior in any sense that we would understand today.
Having looked at the impeachments of Johnson and then of Clinton and, of course, the near impeachment of Richard Nixon, you drew some conclusions about the conditions that sort of have to exist for an impeachment to come onto the public stage. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. It's a very small sample size, and speaking in scientific terms, so you have to be a little cautious about this. But we do have three episodes, and it's in all three, the other party-controlled Congress compared to the president, and it makes sense that that's a situation in which you're looking at impeachment as a possibility. If your own party's in charge, then you really ought to be able to get along without that sort of risk. I also sort of came to the view that even if you're under attack by the other party, if you can keep your own party loyal to you, you've got you ought to be able to survive. And Clinton and Johnson both did that, and they survived. Nixon did not. When Nixon was facing impeachment in the House of Representatives, Republicans abandoned him. And that was essentially the blood in the water that meant to him that he needed to resign, so he did. So although the sample size is very small, I do think those lessons are there to be tested anyway.
And in both the Johnson and the Clinton cases, you see this as sort of a really good pressure valve that's available to our political system when a president finds himself accused of something that people just can't abide.
Very much. Ben Franklin was a wonderful, practical man, and the Constitutional Convention in 1787 said, we have to have something like impeachment, because otherwise if we have a president we don't like, we have to kill him. And it is an opportunity for people who just can't stand the president to be put to the proof. Okay, you think we should get rid of him? Prove your case. And I think in Johnson's case, frankly, the way the accusations against him, they were very legalistic, and they were not that persuasive to people. That was a factor in his survival. I think in Clinton's case, once it became a question of should he be president or not, people ended up saying, well, you know, he may have lied, but, you know, it's not the sort of thing we would remove him as president over. And I think that's a really valuable device that impeachment provides, even though it's sort of an odd mechanism.
Is there anything to admire about the presidency of Andrew Johnson?
I am hard-pressed to come up with much. I think he was... He just wrong-footed the whole nation for several years, and we missed a wonderful opportunity. By the end of his presidency, people were so dug in, and many people at the time wrote how tragic it was that in the first 6 months after the war, an opportunity to really build a consensus between North and South was lost, because Johnson basically told the South they could do whatever they wanted, the Southern leaders. And I just think it's so many missed opportunities, it's difficult for me to find much to celebrate.
David O. Stewart is an attorney and a history writer. His newest book is called Impeached, The Trial of President Andrew Johnson and the Fight for Lincoln's Legacy. David, really fascinating work. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Well, I appreciate it. The opportunity, and your callers are insightful.
They're great.
A pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.